history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told, and we'll never hear them unless we take a little bit of time to ask some questions and listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We really want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Los Gatos, California, with 93, almost 94-year-old, Bill Venuti, originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the son of Italian-American immigrants. What was that childhood like there in Philly, Bill?
It was very unusual, entirely different than how my children grew up. We lived in a neighborhood where there were all Italian immigrants. In Philadelphia, there are these neighborhoods that stick together. And in my part of the city, there were sections that were Irish, and there were Italians, and there were Jewish people, and Polish, and so on. And we had our own neighborhoods. And my street was all Italians, all Italian families, most of them immigrants. And so that's how I grew up. And no parks, that all our recreational activities were in a street. And we made up our own games, football and baseball and so on. In baseball, we used a like a half ball, like a tennis ball cut in half. And that was our ball, and the bat was a broomstick handle. And for football, we couldn't afford a football. Didn't even know what one looked like. So we made our own by just wrapping up newspaper and tying it as our football. Our recreational activities was in the street.
And you mentioned not being able to afford a football. I mean, this is the Great Depression, and those of us living today probably have a hard time fathoming the way things were back then. Yes. What do you look back on and say those were the biggest differences or the starkest contrast?
Well, there's a world of difference between how I grew up and how my children grew up. Entirely different. There we were in an area where there were all people like us, all Italians. So I get to know the families, and most of the Italians who came from Italy couldn't speak English. And many times they could not communicate with each other because of the dialect. There were a number of dialects in Italy. But all the kids I played with were Italian kids like myself. So it was in the street where we played. The nearest park was about a mile away, but sometimes we'd go there too.
And you say park, and I'm thinking of baseball parks, because Philadelphia had two major league teams during that era, the Phillies and the Athletics. Did you follow any of those stars?
Oh, yes, I did. And sometimes there were programs where we could apply for, I guess, a not whole gang, where you can get a ticket free of charge. So that's how I was able to see some of the games of the Phillies and the A's. Yep. So it was interesting doing that.
Any particular characters stand out from that area? And maybe you wore a Connie Mack-style hat or something?
Well, remember Joe DiMaggio being Italian? I remember he's an outfielder sometimes. He'd be just down there about 20 or 30 feet away. That was interesting to see him, and he's a very good player, too. And so it was interesting going to the game. But I never went to too many games. Couldn't afford going to a game. So just what they call the knothole gang.
And I've met a lot of Italians in your age range and people who grew up during that Great Depression. And whether they had a lot or a little, I think every Italian-American veteran who I've interviewed talks about the food his mother used to make. Did your mom have a specialty of that Italian cuisine?
The popular dish is pasta and meatballs and bracciolo. So, and a big meal would be on Sunday, of course. My mother would, of course, we'd go to church every Sunday morning, and my mother would put this large pot of pasta sauce on a stove, had it simmer for an hour and a half, we're in church and come back. And of course, you know what bracciolo is? You put bracciolo in there, and that would be cooking, then come back and then do the pasta, and we'd have a pretty big meal. That was our biggest meal of the week. As I recall, we also had pasta on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And Friday was, of course, fish day, because Friday, you didn't want to eat meat. Of course, it was sinful. Anyway, so that was how we had our meals. The house we lived in was very small, the row house. On our street, there were 25 houses on each side of the street over the common wall, and so we got to know the neighbors pretty well. But the house were pretty well built because they had brick walls, and you can't hear anybody from next door, except if they were in the backyard. So the house was quite small, and we had two bedrooms and one bathroom and a basement. At one time, we didn't have any hot water, a hot water heater, so in order to take a bath, which the bathtub was upstairs, the bathroom, we'd have to put a big pan of water on a stove in the kitchen and carry it up and hope you don't trip and burn yourself to death.
That does sound a lot different from what your kids and your grandkids, I'm sure, have experienced. But back then, I'm sure you weren't thinking about kids or grandkids. You're thinking, what am I going to do when I grow up? Do you remember some dreams or ambitions you had as a child?
I played the drums at that time. I wanted to be a drummer. I played with some small groups, but never got anywhere with it. That was one of my ambitions. In high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. In high school, I was in what they call an industrial program, and they also had other programs which were more academic. In industrial programs, most of our class were in shops, like wood shop or metal shop or whatever, welding. So did a lot of that. So when I graduated from high school, I worked for a year. The war had just started. As a matter of fact, the war started when I graduated. I graduated in January 42. Anyway, so I heard Roosevelt give us a speech.
Well, let's talk about that, because I've yet to meet a veteran who doesn't remember something about how he or she found out about the Pearl Harbor attack. What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember it was a Sunday. I was walking down the street, and somehow I heard a radio program coming from one of the houses with an open window about the Japanese having attacked Pearl Harbor. And I had no idea where Pearl Harbor was or that I would end up in the Navy and be in Pearl Harbor. But anyway, so I didn't know my geography that well. Anyway, so I worked for a year in a machine shop and decided to join the Navy. Otherwise, I would have been drafted into the Army. So that's how I got into the Navy. And I went to boot camp for, I think it was 2 months or so. I was playing the drums. I wanted to join the U.S. Navy Band, which is stationed in Washington. There was a chief petty officer who was, name was Charlie Bassetti, Italian name, who was also a drummer. He was the teacher of Gene Krupa. You know the drummer Gene Krupa?
Sure.
Yeah. So I got to meet him. He gave me an examination of what to do in the drums. He said, you're not good enough for the U.S. Navy Band, but I'll send you to San Diego. It was a program where they took the draftees who were musicians. These were guys from various named bands and formed band groups. And they would be assigned to large ships and different naval bases around the world. So I said, I'll send you there. So that was a good deal for me. I still wasn't good enough. These guys who were there were from name bands or great drummers.
And when you say name bands, you mean the people that you might hear on the radio or that play in concerts at different places, the bands that you were familiar with?
Tom Dorsey and Artie Shaw and Gene Krupa and those bands. Yes, They were the swing bands at the time. We'd have about 16 pieces. And they would put on performances. They would travel around the country. And I remember going to theaters where they would be performing. Anyway, so these drummers were very good. And so I did not stay there very long. So I was sent to Pearl Harbor. And I was asked what kind of ship I wanted to be put on. So thinking it'd be safer to be on a battleship. So I selected a battleship. And lo and behold, they gave me the USS North Carolina.
Which would be the most decorated battleship of World War II with 15 battle stars. But when you say you think it would be safe to be on a battleship, you also just said you were at Pearl Harbor. And on December 7th at Pearl Harbor, the battleship Arizona is sunk. The battleship Oklahoma is sunk. The battleships like the West Virginia and the Tennessee and the Pennsylvania are all damaged. So did you really think a battleship was going to be safe?
Well, I compared it to smaller ships like destroyers. I thought that the bigger the ship, the safer it would be. So, and lo and behold, they gave me a battleship, too. That happened even before I was in San Francisco at the time, and they gave me this questionnaire, and I filled it out. I selected a battleship, and lo and behold, they said, I can be assigned to a battleship. So I went from San Francisco to Pearl Harbor and onto the battleship. North Carolina was doing active duty at the time, but they had been torpedoed, but that was repaired sometime before this time they were in Pearl Harbor. But it was in dry dock, and they had to repair the rudder and the steering apparatus. Anyway, so it was in dry dock. It was being repaired, so I was in Pearl Harbor for about a month before they filled up the dry dock and sailed out of there. So that was it.
Well, and I'm curious, you're at Pearl Harbor, you said, for a month. Did you have a chance to see or take in any of the aftermath, the evidence of what had happened there? Were there signs still there of what had happened back in December of 41?
Yes, I had a chance to. Of course, it wasn't only the ships that were damaged. The airfield was pretty well destroyed, too. So I went to see some of the ships and the air base, and some of the destroyed planes were still there when I got there. This was in 42, so just a year afterwards.
You went over to Hickam Field?
Yes, right, Hickam Field, that's right. So I did that. And it's real easy to get there. I didn't pay bus or anything because you hitchhike, and with a uniform, people would pick you up. So, so it worked out pretty well.
Did that stir anything in you? Was that impactful to see with your own eyes in person as opposed to a newspaper or hearing it on the radio that this is what this enemy, Imperial Japan, has done to the U.S.?
I was 18 years old. I didn't think about that at all. I just knew that I would be doing my duty by serving in the Navy, and that was it. So I was on the ship for just one night before they assigned me to the division that I stayed in for the time I was on the ship. They issue a hammock, which you carry around with you. I stayed in the hammock only one night. That was the first night on the ship. Then they sent me to the lookout division. I was a lookout, but they had bunks, four deep, so on. So I was in the lookout division all that time. But the good thing about the being a lookout division is that there were two or three different battle stations where lookouts would be. And mine was at the top of the ship, they call sky control. And you can see all around, so it was interesting place to be as far as seeing all the activity during the invasions and Japanese planes coming in and so on. So I saw quite a bit of that. Five of the major battles I was in. The first one was the Gilbert Islands and the Marshall Islands, Truk and New Guinea.
Well, and I want to hear about what you saw in those circumstances, because you did have a unique vantage point that most of the 2,000 plus guys on your ship wouldn't have seen. But you mentioned that when you got on the ship at Pearl, it was in dry dock getting repaired because it had been torpedoed by the Japanese. Did that bother you at all? Did that question the confidence you had in this ship? It's already been banged up a little bit?
It received one torpedo and five men were killed. This was about maybe 4 or 5 months before I got on the ship. And I didn't think that was all that bad. I thought I'd be safer at the top of the ship than being below the waterline. And being a lookout, of course, I saw all the activity. Maybe one-third of the crew were below with the main decks and couldn't see anything at all. So I was in a real good position, too. And I just enjoyed doing it, too, because I was scared at first. The first Japanese attacker, you just don't know if you're going to be killed or not. And so, but then one gets used to it and just think of doing your duty as a lookout and reporting where the explosions were, where the Japanese planes were, and so on. We sometimes have practices, too, and then sometimes a real thing. Before the battle begins, there's an announcement throughout the entire ship that all hands man your battle station, man your battle stations. Then there's a signal going boom, 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 boom. And from that point, wherever you are, you have to get to your battle station. And most of the time, I was in my quarters, which is one deck below the main deck. So I had to run from there to the top of the ship in about 1 minute, no hesitation at all. Uh-huh. Sometimes climb the ladder on the outside of the conning tower, then into the battle station. At the battle station where I was, it was called Sky Control. The front part had what they called alidays, or four of them. It's a contraption where you sit down in a seat and you have handlebars and you swing around horizontally so you can see different areas. And of course the handlebars are such that you have binoculars on the end that can go up and down so they can see whatever you want. So that was my battle station. There were four of us, and then there was an officer who would guide us and also relate what we saw to the bridge and so on.
Well, you mentioned the first time you had to deal with a battle situation. You gave us a little sense of what that felt like. Can you walk us through that step by step, though? What you're looking for, where, what you're seeing, what's going through your mind that first time you encountered the enemy?
I have to back up and tell you that we had 102 ships in our fleet, 102 ships. Of course, the main ship was the aircraft carriers, which did the bombarding and try to shoot down the Japanese planes. So there were 8 carriers and in the middle of the array of ships, then a circle of battleships, 8 battleships. North was one of them. And then around the circle of battleships were heavy cruisers, then light cruisers, then destroyers, 102 ships in all. The first battle that I was in Gilbert Islands. This was one of the first major invasions, too. Of course, the Japanese were coming there, so they prepared for that, and sometimes there'd be submarines in the area. So in order to avoid being hit by a torpedo, the path we would take us, we are moving along at high speed, which is about 33 miles an hour, we have a zigzag pattern. So all ships would have to go in one direction for 3 or 4 minutes, then another direction, a random direction. And of course, each ship had to be right on, and why there'd be collisions, and what there was a collision. Anyway, that was our mode of operation. But it was fascinating seeing from sky control where I was all these ships and the movements and so on. And, of course, occasionally it would be Japanese in a year or two and be sending their torpedoes in different directions. So as a lookout, I would have to indicate where there was a torpedo wake and relay that to the officer, and the officers were sent down to the bridge. But a typical battle would be we would be preparing to bombard and then invade the islands, like Gilbert and Marshall Islands and other places. But anyway, so the order of operation would be to send the heavy ships, but I guess all of them would circle the islands, and the heavy ships would bombard the Japanese islands. And my job would be to indicate where the hits were, where the large explosions were. It was quite common to see a building with a big Red Cross on, indicating it was a hospital. But they realized that it was not a hospital. It was where they kept their armament. So I've had to point out where that was located and where the explosions were. That would take place first. That would be one day, and then the following day, the invasion would take place.
Well, I've got to ask you, I'm listening to you, and I'm imagining myself in your shoes, and it actually kind of sounds like what I do a lot. I go to sporting events and describe the play-by-play of what's happening. It sounds like you had to give a little play-by-play of the battle, but what's your frame of reference when you say, I have to say where the shells are hitting? Did you have a grid? Are you just using, you know, compass directions? How do you describe and pass on that information so it's accurate?
Well, I had a view of the entire island. Maybe not, but most of the island. And I would indicate what part of the island the large explosions took place. And I would never see the troops land. That came afterwards. So that was my job. And also indicate where there were torpedo wakes and where they were heading, and so the ships couldn't avoid them.
I'm sure as you listen today, you can imagine what that felt like. But we're going to explore more of Bill Venuti's World War II story when we come back. And there are some twists and turns his journey has taken since World War II that I think you're going to enjoy hearing about as well. Find photos of Bill then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
3328. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Dr. Bill Venuti. We'll hear how that doctorate came about for a guy who had never even heard of college, he says, before joining the Navy as a teenager in World War II. He served on the battleship USS North Carolina, which you can go see for yourself. It's a museum ship in Wilmington, North Carolina. Later, we're going to hear how often Bill makes it out there from his home in Los Gatos, California. But for now, let's go back to his time aboard World War II's most decorated battleship, which participated deployed in every major naval operation of the war in the Pacific. He was a lookout on the North Carolina for five major battles in 1943 and 44, shelling all those islands you've heard of in the Gilberts, the Marshalls, the Marianas, and more.
When the Japanese planes would come in, their mode of operation would be to, they knew we were going to come in and bombard the islands. They had knowledge of the 102 ships in the area. They would send from different places where they had their airports, mostly about 80 of the, they call them Betty bombers, either bombers or torpedoes and bombs. Anyway, they would send them in before the bombardment, the night before the bombardment, but before it got dark. They didn't want to come in during daylight because they'd been shot down pretty easily. So they waited until it got dark. So, of course, we were taking our zigzag pattern. And what they do with their 80 planes or whatever number there were, they would circle around where the ships were. Of course, we had like 120 planes for each of the eight carriers, but we can't send them up because the planes would come back in the dark, and it's very difficult to land a plane in the dark on a carrier. So all we did, we had to wait for them to come in, so we'd have a zigzag pattern, and then when it was completely dark, when we could not see them from below, they'd send their planes in and do their bombarding and drop the torpedoes. They would also drop flares. The flares were on parachutes. And so the lights from the flares, you could see all the ships, not like daylight, but you could see the outline of the ships. They could see too. So they knew which ships to attack and where to drop the torpedoes. So my job was to indicate where the planes were coming from, how many there were, and so on. That's my job, was to look out.
Yeah, so you're passing on that information so your ship and others can use their anti-aircraft guns to try to shoot down these Japanese planes. That just, for a teenager, that sounds like a lot of responsibility. You've got a lot of lives at stake based on how quickly and accurately you perceive and pass on that information.
That's true. Of course, our ship had 16-inch guns, real big. They had a range of like 25 miles, and these were used to bombard the islands. It would be about 10 or 15,000 yards offshore when we did the bombarding. But also, we had anti-aircraft. We had 20-millimeter guns, 40-millimeter guns, and so on, the 5-inch guns. And so the 5-inch guns and the 20-millimeter and 40-millimeter would be used to shoot down the planes. We would try to shoot down as many planes as possible. Of course, sometimes we didn't know when they were coming in, that be above the flares, they would come in below the flares. Then we could see them and start to fire at them. And, of course, they would try to hit, once they knew they were going to fall in the water after they were shot down, they tried to hit a ship. And on several occasions, they tried to hit our ship. So I remember one where forward right side of the ship, a plane tried to crash into our ship. And we were moving along, and it just landed in the water, and we were going by it, and the pilot was coming out, and the gunners, we just let him have it. It was going to die anyway, but they're screaming and yelling at the same time they're doing it. So that was interesting to see.
And you're watching all of this unfold. You had a view that very few people in the war ever had. What was that like? Was that exciting? Was that frightening? Did you get an adrenaline rush? What did that feel like to be up there seeing that expansive view of what was happening?
Of course, this is a long time ago, but I can recall that I was frightened the first time and the second time. But then there are so many times that these planes came in that one gets used to it. So you just think of doing your duty and observing where the bombs were landing, where the planes were. So that's what you're thinking about rather than your own safety. So I remember the first time I thought, well, I could be killed. But then you don't think about it afterwards. Just do your duty and hope for the best. And luckily our ship was not hit all the time I was on it.
Yeah, your ship, for being the most decorated battleship, survived impressively well. If you look back and you think about the five battles that you were involved in, or maybe even some of the weather you encountered, or the different hazards that you faced or potentially could face, what do you look back on and say, you know, that was probably the closest call?
The fact that there were as many as 80 bombers in the area trying to sink our ships or land on the ships if they were shot down, always thought that was a possibility. But once one becomes involved in their duty in spotting planes and where the bombs were landing, you don't think about that, about being hit or killed. You just do your duty and carry through.
Well, and you know, most things in life, there's a little bit of margin for error. But it strikes me that you didn't have much margin for error here. You make one mistake or you miss one plane or one threat, and it could cost people their lives.
Yeah, that is true. So, but one doesn't think about that. Just think of doing your duty and doing your best. Of course, I was the only one. There were three others in my battle station. We also had a lookout battle station in the back part of the ship where there were two or three guys too. So we all did the same thing at that time.
Well, that was another question I thought of is, what was it like with the other guys on that ship? What kind of rapport or camaraderie did you build?
Of course, they were also in lookout division, so I knew them personally. So you have friendship with them, but normally we did not communicate with each other during the battle. We just indicate what we saw. We had one officer who was in charge, and we report what we saw to him, and he would convey that information down to the bridge.
Did you ever hear from home while you were out there?
We would get mail periodically. The mail would come in with another kind of ship, and they would transport the mail and also food and supplies and so on from one ship to another. But included would be the mail. That would occur only when we're probably in port. So that happened very often. And so after a battle, we would sometimes, depending upon the battle, go into one of the islands where we could anchor and get supply with oil or food and mail and so forth. So sometimes we would anchor when we would come in, and the cargo ship would anchor next to us, and they would send one of these devices across and transfer all the supplies that way. Sometimes it would be while we're underway, too. That's a lot more difficult, where the cargo ship would be underway next to our ship, and they would throw what I have to call a monkey's fist, a heavy weight with rope around it, and throw it to the other ship, maybe 40, 50, 60 feet, something like that. That would be a light line, then it would be heavier line, then a heavier line, until it was heavy enough that he could tie the two ships together, and he would sail at the same time together. And of course, I would always see that too, so it was fun. Then, of course, there are times where we're not a battle, so we have workstations where my scrape paint, peeling paint, the decks were made of hardwood, and we would have to, what they call holy stone the decks. One of my workstations would have water hose and water down the deck, and then the holy stone was just like a normal brick with a hole in it, and you have a handle you put in the hole, and you would rub the deck when it's water to clean out the dirt and debris and so on. So that's one of my workstations.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun job. What would you say was the most difficult or challenging aspect of your duty?
Most challenging, making sure that I had the right information that I reported a bomb landing on the island and where it landed, and where the planes were too, when I would indicate that, or where the torpedo works were. Those were challenging, you know.
And I imagine you were thinking you'd probably stay on the North Carolina till this thing was over, till the Allies won, but that's not what happened.
I assume that would be the case, yes. I was prepared to do that until the end of the war. I liked the duty I had because it was fairly easy, and being able to see all the activity from sky control was very interesting. But I had no idea that I'd be on a ship only 6 or 7 months. As I mentioned, they needed more officers from the others who were not in the Navy, and they were running out of civilians. So they delved into the enlisted ranks. Now it's just a seaman first class. There were 2,300 on the ship, 2,300 enlisted, and 120 officers, and a handful, like 5 or 6 Marine officers also. So they gave us an opportunity to take an examination to determine our qualifications for officer training. So of 2,300, 120 seamen applied for officer training. I did that. So then they took a second examination. They narrowed down to 60, and then 30, then 15. So only 15 of those who applied went back to officer training. But my objective was not to get a commission, was just to get back home. And so at that time, I had no intention of going to college. My parents were uneducated. My father was illiterate. So college was not a part of our family conversation at all. The main objective was to get a high school diploma. So anyway, on the ship, my objective was just to get back home for a while. I was fortunate. I did pretty well, and the captain of the ship interviewed each one of us. That was an honor to be interviewed by the captain. So, but my objective was to get back to Philadelphia more than anything else. So I didn't know much about where universities were. I always wanted to go to Texas somehow. And so didn't know whether University of Texas or not. So that was one of my choices. But I knew about the University of Pennsylvania and Temple University in Philadelphia. So I selected those three. And lo and behold, they sent me back to University of Pennsylvania.
So I want people to hear what you said there, that you never had any thoughts of college, that that wasn't really even a possibility in your family. But here, instead of spending the rest of the war out at sea, you get sent back to the States, to your hometown, to attend an Ivy League school and study on the Navy's dime. That's a pretty good deal.
How fortunate can one be? And I had no intention of ever going to college. And so while I was there, of course, I was in the V-12 program, then was ROTC program. At first, they were going to make us officers after only 90 days of college. But then the demand wasn't there anymore, so they extended it to 3 years. At that time, one could get a degree in 3 years. Of course, they had a semester during the summer months. So in 3 years, I was able to get my degree and my commission at the same time. So I was pretty busy. So I wasn't a very good student. I wasn't even prepared. My high school grades weren't very good. Not that I couldn't have done better, but it wasn't too important to me. So, and I was in the, you know, you divide the graduating class into two quintiles every 20%, and I was in the third quintile from the top. So anyway, I could have done better, but I never intended to go to college. I don't think I knew what a college or university was.
Wow.
Of course, that's not a subject of conversation where your parents are immigrants. They said they went to second or third grade. That's all they had. My father was illiterate. He couldn't write anything except his name, so... Mm-hmm. And Italian too, so.
Well, and people are going to be surprised a little bit to hear where your story ends up in terms of academics and universities. But let's continue with where you were. So you're at the University of Pennsylvania. The war's still going on. Did you ever miss your buddies on the North Carolina?
I kept thinking about them, and several were from Philadelphia area. So when the war was over, they came back. I did maintain contact with them. So there are a few of them, but not very many.
And what did that mean to you when the war was over, when you heard that Japan had surrendered? How much satisfaction did that bring?
Okay, I was a student at the university at that time, in my last year, I believe. It meant that I had an opportunity to just continue with my college education or working and doing whatever. And I thought that I participated and made a small contribution toward the victory that we had. It was an interesting time to know that the war was over. Of course, we didn't know when the war would end. But it ended before we thought it would, thank goodness.
Yeah, I guess if it had continued, and if there would have been a need to invade mainland Japan, perhaps you would have been heading back over as a newly commissioned officer?
Very likely, right. But when I got my degree, I got my commission at the same time. And at the time, they encouraged me to stay in the Navy. I had a choice of just not continuing in the Navy and just become a civilian, which I did. And the information I had is that if I stayed in the Navy and was promoted to higher ranks during my period of time in the Navy, it would be very difficult to get promoted because my commission was from the ROTC, and I would be competing against those who received a commission at Annapolis. And the people from Annapolis were favored. So understanding that, I decided not to continue in the Navy. So I just resigned my commission and started working.
And what was that first degree in from the University of Pennsylvania?
Bachelor of Arts. The segment of the university where they give the Bachelor of Arts is called the College. I think it's still called that. So my major was in mathematics.
And the reason I said first degree is because this guy who never thought about college got a lot more than one degree. Tell me what else you went on to earn in the academic realm and then what you did as a career.
Okay, very briefly, without making a long story, I stayed in reserves where I could go to a meeting for 3 hours once a month and during the summer for 2 weeks be on active duty. And so I did that for about 12 years, and I was promoted to full lieutenant at that time. But as a civilian all the time, my first job out of college was as a junior level engineer in Philadelphia. Worked for a year there and learned a little more about engineering, although my degree was in mathematics, not engineering. And so I gave engineering some consideration, and I read where there were opportunities to work for the Bureau of Reclamation as an engineering trainee in Denver. So I took the examination, did okay, went to Denver. That's how my graduate education began. So I was in Denver and worked for them for a year, but nighttime I took night courses in Denver at the University of Colorado. Went back to the campus for another year and they will get my degree in civil engineering. And then at that time I got married too, so.
And that's quite a story in itself, which we'll hear about when we come back. Plus, how a guy who had never heard of college became an engineering professor at San Jose State for more than 40 years. Plus, his experience with Honor Flight Bay Area, and even a quick word from one of his sons, himself a Silicon Valley success story. Hometown Heroes will come right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and another reminder that every veteran story is unique. Another example of the unpredictable ways in which military service in World War II redirected a teenager's life, which then, of course, would have an impact far beyond that individual. 93-year-old Bill Venuti has shared about his experience on the battleship USS North Carolina, how the Navy gave him a chance to go to college. A math degree from Penn was followed by an engineering degree at Colorado, and when we left off, he mentioned getting married during his time in the Rocky Mountain State, but I think you'll want to hear the unique way he met his wife, Twyla, who had been instructing pilots and link trainers during the war.
I decided to stay in Denver and continue my education at the University of Colorado, but I had to go back home to Philadelphia to get my clothes and other personal things. At that time, one would be able to hitch a ride to another state or across the country by looking at ad in the paper. People advertise. They wanted a rider or someone to help drive, so on. So I answered the ad. So we had to pick up one of the riders going back and went to her house. And this was the house where my wife had stayed for the summer with her brother's family. She just graduated. So Twyla just graduated from college at Geneva College in Pennsylvania. You're sure she's from Denver and she went to Pennsylvania, but Western Pennsylvania. For her degree, and she was asked to be assistant business manager, and so she had to go back there to take the job. But she spent the summer with her brother, and so it was in September when she was preparing to go back, and there's a woman who advertised a paper for riders. She's going back to Germany to see her son. So I was one of the riders and went to my wife Twyla's house with her brother and picked her up. And that's how we met. She was very embarrassed, I remember, because she had been to a dance, an outdoor dance, and had rained, her hair was hanging out. She said, I'm embarrassed. I went, no, don't worry about that. Anyway, so we got in a car, and one of the riders got off in Kansas, a young guy about 16 or 17, who wanted to drive too. But he drove for a while, but he's a bad driver, so we didn't let him drive. So my wife and I did most of the driving. And across the country, driving across the country, we just told each other our life history. So we got to the East Coast. She dropped me off in Philadelphia, and she went on to New York, where this woman is going to take a plane or ship. And Twyla flew back to Geneva College in Western Pennsylvania to accept her job. So we had each other's addresses, so. And phone numbers. Didn't phone very much, mostly correspondence. And so I went back to Denver. We corresponded, and I think that we fell in love just with correspondence over a period of time. So that started in September, and by March, she said that she'd like to come back to Denver. And so she did come back to Denver and worked, and we got to know each other pretty well. So September comes around, and we got married. So we got married today. We met 1 year later. That's how it all began. I think I'm fortunate I have met her and have a wonderful family with 6 kids, 5 sons and 1 daughter. I've had a fortunate life. I'm just so thankful for that.
As well you should be. And we still have to hear the rest of that story of how you ended up helping to revolutionize the engineering department at San Jose State University and teaching there for more than four decades.
I had my bachelor's degree working for a Bureau of Commission. I received a call from the head of the department. His name was Rader. He says, Bill, says Professor Rader, I want you to come back and teach. And I said, you know who you're talking to? You want me to teach? I never gave you consideration. Never thought I would be a teacher or a professor. If I know who I'm talking to, my grades were good, better than they were before. So we went to Boulder, and in 3 years, I was able to get my master's degree and also teach full-time, the lower-level courses. Then I gave consideration to continue teaching, and so I applied for teaching positions around the country. I'd be willing to go anywhere. And the only offer I had was San Jose State. So, well, I accepted it. And so I picked up the kids, and Steve was one of the three kids at the time. We got in our car, and from Denver or Boulder, we hopped over to San Jose. So there we were. And I had been in California before, because when I returned from the ship to go to officer training, I was in San Francisco for a little while. Anyway, so here was San Jose State. The interesting thing is that the engineering program was low level, more like a technician program. So some of us felt that we ought to beef up the program. So we improved the quality of the courses and applied for accreditation, which I never had before. And so our civil engineering program became accredited. 3- and 4- and 5-year accreditations. We received a 5-year accreditation, which was very, very good. We were proud of that. So then I thought, well, I think I'll just stay with teaching and maybe consider going elsewhere too. And of course, being close to Stanford, I thought, well, I had a master's degree, but in order to be promoted to full professor and to be better qualified, should have a PhD. So I started taking courses part-time at Stanford. Then I received the National Science Foundation, a government organization. You could apply for full tuition, and they would match your salary. They select like 1 out of 5 applies. Luckily, I was accepted. So I went to Stanford. At first, I was taking one course at a time while teaching full-time. Then I applied for this. I then went to the campus for a whole year and finished up all my courses and got my PhD and continued teaching at San Jose State. I considered teaching elsewhere, but I was pretty well established there at San Jose State, new to students, new to faculty and the administration, so I just stayed there.
So how long did you teach at San Jose State?
I taught for 45 years there. Well, yeah, the first year after I got my PhD, I had an opportunity to teach in Bangkok, in Thailand. At that time, there was a military alliance between Western countries and the countries in the Pacific Ocean. When they thought that China was going to invade, come down to North Korea and South Korea, Malaysia, so on, and then Singapore, so on. That was their plan. So it was a military alliance that was formed, the U.S., the U.K., Canada, and France. So it had a military alliance. So they would have the military exercises periodically in preparation for a possible invasion by China. But they also had non-military programs. Their pride and joy was they had a graduate school of engineering. It was the only graduate school of engineering in Southeast Asia. I was asked to teach there full-time for a 2-year assignment. So I picked up the family off to Thailand. So we're in Bangkok for 2 years. I taught in China for 1 semester, 4 months. The students were graduate students, and they had to have a writing and speaking ability of English in order to get their master's degree. So the class were in English. And of course, their English left a lot to be desired, and so I spoke very slowly and distinctly. So I taught there for 4 months.
I know this may sound a little melodramatic, but in listening to you describe all of this, I'm just struck by one question or one decision point that you faced as a teenager. And you described this for us. You said you joined the Navy because you knew if you didn't enlist and you waited to be drafted, you would have gone into the Army. Have you ever wondered how different your life would have been had you waited around for Uncle Sam to draft you?
All the time, because some of my friends were in the Army and some were killed. And I thought I could have been killed very easily in Europe. So I thought how fortunate I was to have joined the Navy. I thought about it at that time. Not anymore, but at that time I did.
And even if you had made it through, you might never have gone to college. You certainly never would have encountered your wife. You know, you've got 6 kids and 8 grandkids. There's a lot of what ifs there, aren't there?
I think about that all the time. Of course I do. Yes, I've been a different person. I might not be alive right now either.
So how do you explain that? Why do you think things worked out the way they did? What's your explanation?
I have no idea. Just so happened I made the right decision at the right time. It worked out just wonderfully for me. And I just think how fortunate I was that these things did occur at the right time. And I'm where I am today.
And another unique thing about your situation, because that, you know, I can't tell you how many Navy vets I've interviewed, but it's only a handful who can still go back to the very ship that they served on and see the exact spot where they used to serve their duty. And you have that privilege because the North Carolina is a museum ship in Wilmington, North Carolina. How often do you get back there and see that old hunk of metal?
They have the reunion only once a year. Of course, the ship is open year-round as a tourist attraction. I go back there anytime I want. But I go back there when we have our crew reunion, which is generally in the third or fourth week in April. So it's just once a year for a period of 5 or 6 days. So it's a good time to interact with the former crew members. There's no case where I would encounter crew members that were on a ship when I was. So, of course, I knew only a handful. There were 25 people in my division, so I knew them pretty well. And get to know a few other people, but there's a ship of over 2,000. You don't get to know many people. So there was no case where I encounter anyone that I knew on the ship.
But you go back there every single year and you take your family?
Every single year. As the time goes on, the word gets out that it was just a good experience for everybody. So we get more and more people. The last time, I think there were 6 or 7. I think that this coming year, more people want to go. I think might have as many as 15 people.
From your family?
My family, right. And this is a rare case because most of the crew members bring their wife or maybe a child, maybe one or two people at the most. But here you have, this time we had 7 or 8 people. And so we became a pretty popular. People kept looking at us, the whole family there. and they all enjoyed interacting with the other people. So now they came back home and other members of the family hear the stories. Then more people want to go by. So I think we'll have a larger number of people this coming year than we had this year.
And what do you personally get out of that?
I just enjoy the travel part to be in North Carolina. The ship's in Wilmington, which is a tourist attraction. I get to see it, but also to recall memories of having been on a ship, and especially when I'm able to take the entire family, climb up the conning tower to the top and show my battle station. It's just a thrill to be able to show my family where I was and tell some war stories while I was up there too.
Yeah. You know? And I'm sure some people are hearing that and say, wait, this guy's going to be 94 next month and he can still climb all the way up to that sky bridge in the same lookout spot he occupied more than 70 years ago?
Probably not as fast as I got up there before. We had to get up there in 1 minute. Remember, one time, only once. The decks have openings. So if there might be a ladder, you know, these rungs on the side of the conning tower to climb up there, and when you get to the deck at the top, the sky control, there's a hatch can open up so a person can go through. So to keep it closed during battle, because people are walking around. So I got there a little late one time, and it was closed, and bang! Ooh. I could have fallen about 20 feet and killed myself. But anyway, I held on.
You smacked it right with the top of your head?
Boom, on top of the head. Right? I thought it would be open. It might have been at nighttime, so I couldn't see.
Well, and so you take that sentimental journey annually with your family back to Wilmington, but you also had another recent trip where you went with Honor Flight Bay Area, along with other veterans, to Washington, D.C. to see the National World War II Memorial. What kind of emotions or thoughts or memories or awareness did that stir in you on that trip?
Well, we had a chance to see all the memorials for the Vietnam War and World War II and so on. And I recall having seen the Vietnam War Memorial where they had names of the, how many, 58,000, yes, names. And I thought how fortunate I was to have been in the Navy even during the war at that time. And having survived, you think these 58, 56, how many?
58 in Vietnam, more than 50 in Korea, and more than 406,000 in World War II when you served. And there at the World War II Memorial, you've got that wall of gold stars that represents all those guys. Looking at that, what went through your mind as you looked at that wall of gold stars?
I just felt how fortunate I was to have survived this and be educated also and have a good life in addition. So I felt, how does it happen? One doesn't know, but it did happen, and I'm so thankful for it.
And what on that trip with Honor Flight, what would you say the highlight of that experience was, or were there any surprises or things you didn't expect?
I enjoyed interacting with my colleagues of the Honor Flight who also went along, and meeting their families and visiting different sites with them too. And we seemed to be celebrities when we were there, so that felt good too. So anyway, so I enjoyed the entire visit completely.
Well, there's one thing I haven't said yet that I need to, and that's thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing your unique and incredible story with us. As you look back, and I know you're not done yet, I know you got a lot to look forward to, but as you look back, is there something you'd say you're most proud of?
I don't know if I would call it being proud. I just would call it being fortunate that I am where I am, having had the education, having had an interesting family and friends, and to be able to travel many places around the world. I just feel so fortunate. Things just seem to have turned out right for me. I'm so thankful for that. And my health is very good, which I'm also thankful for.
And last thing, I mean, and you do this every year where you go back to your ship with your kids and grandkids. So I'm sure you have these conversations with them about what you were doing back then and why it matters. So for most of the world today, which didn't live through World War II and really has no idea what was happening then, what do you think we need to understand and remember about what you and the rest of America did all those years ago?
Well, it was a very turning point in the history of our country, and it could have gone the other way too. So I think we're very fortunate that it turned out the way it did, and we had the allies that we did too. So it worked out very well, so I'm thankful for that too.
That is Bill Venuti, 93 years old. He turns 94 in August, and he's looking forward to another trip back to his ship, the USS North Carolina. So is his family, which includes 6 children and 8 grandchildren. His son, Steve, gives us a little extra perspective before we wrap up today.
I think my father's exceedingly modest. And if you look at kind of where he came from and where he ended up, you know, no one wants war. And obviously World War II was a huge worldwide conflict. But I imagine it changed anyone's life who it impacted dramatically. And my father's immensely so. I remember one thing he told me that when he was in high school, he told me he did not even know that college existed. He didn't even know that was an option. And then to think that, you know, he ends up getting a PhD at Stanford, one of the finest universities in the world, that would never have happened if this huge conflict hadn't essentially created upheaval worldwide. And, you know, no question, we would much rather it never happen. And sorry, Dad, you didn't get your PhD at Stanford. But, you know, but it tells you the kind of global impact that has on everyone's lives. Certainly a lot of unfortunate impact. And there's a lot of other positive impact that it has just in terms of the generation that came out of that. And, you know, my generation, too, who was lucky enough to share this with my father and my mother, who was also in the service, and understand the commitment, the dedication, and just the hard work that came out of it and brought us to where we are now.
That is the bottom line. We would not be where we are without him. True for all of us in a figurative sense, and for so many of us, a literal sense as well. Don't forget to find the photos of Dr. Bill Venuti then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.